Okay, let's unpack this strange true story behind what locals in Pleasant Park, Vermont, called the real-life Ninja Turtles.
Right, and it sounds like something straight out of fiction, but it's not.
No, definitely not. We're not dealing with comic books or, late-night cartoons here.
Not at all.
What we are doing is taking a deep dive into this, fascinating, kind of chilling, and meticulously documented cold case. It dates back to the mid-1960s.
And the core of it involves highly illegal science, like completely government unapproved experiments.
Yeah, and it's all centered around this bizarre goal, trying to achieve biological immortality, essentially, but for house pets.
Which is strange enough on its own, but then it leads to this single, absolutely terrifying night where, get this, 25 townspeople ended up fighting for their lives.
Against what? Against, bipedal, highly aggressive research turtles.
It sounds completely fantastic, doesn't it? Yet our sources, the documentation we've pulled together, they confirm the specifics of this documented disaster.
So our mission today for this deep dive is really to define the scope of what's known as the Vermont's Mutant Turtles of Pleasant Park incident.
Exactly. We're examining specific records, piecing together the events where this secret, completely unapproved experiment spun out of control.
And led directly to a major public safety catastrophe.
Right.
I mean, it permanently altered the history and definitely the folklore of this otherwise quiet New England town.
It really did.
And the thing that truly makes this story stick, what defines the sheer audacity of it all, it's the hiding place, the central
Oh,
irony.
absolutely.
You've got this operation dedicated to basically tampering with the fundamental laws of aging, right? A really dark secret. And it's concealed beneath the single greatest symbol of public trust and, vetted knowledge in the entire town.
The public library.
The public library. It's just, wow.
Yeah. We've consolidated the companion sources for this deep dive, pulled everything together. And as we go through the timeline, we really have to maintain, rigorous factual restraint. Stick only to what's documented.
Right, no speculation beyond the records.
But even just sticking to the facts, the narrative itself forces us to explore how this, seemingly innocuous goal making pets live longer, somehow morphed into this incredibly violent confrontation.
And exposing this deep vein of what scientific hubris, arrogance
Yeah.
operating right under everyone's
That was
noses.
precisely hiding in the most ironic place imaginable.
Okay, let's dig in.
Yep.
Act away. Let's really anchor ourselves immediately in the setting. We're talking Pleasant Park, Vermont. And the period is the 1960s.
Mid-60s.
And when you think of Vermont back then, you probably picture what? Covered bridges, beautiful fall foliage, maybe maple syrup.
Yeah, that kind of quintessential New England charm. A bit isolated, maybe, community focus.
Exactly. It's really the archetype of a place where nothing sensational, nothing scientifically earth-shattering is supposed to happen.
Right. And that perception, that perceived calm, that veneer of small town normalcy, that was exactly what these researchers leveraged. They counted on it.
It seems so.
Because the core structural fact, the absolute linchpin of this entire incident, is the precise location of their illegal operation.
Which we mentioned, but it bears repeating.
It does. The sources confirm, without a doubt, that a highly illegal, fully functional biological testing laboratory was constructed and then operated underneath the town's public library.
I have to pause on that again because the location isn't just a quirky detail, it's a statement, isn't it?
It really is. Think about what the public library represents.
Yeah, it's supposed to be this repository of approved knowledge, accessible, vetted information. It's usually a center of civic pride, enlightenment.
A place of trust.
Totally.
Yeah.
So to hide illicit, dangerous, potentially world-altering science there, science dedicated to essentially breaking biological boundaries. It feels like a profound act of betrayal, psychologically, civically.
It really does. It suggests this research team felt they were, I don't know, above the very structures of community knowledge and trust, operating on a different plane entirely.
And the logistics of it.
Yeah.
That's what gets me too.
Well, exactly. What's fascinating here is the sheer logistics and, frankly, the technological confidence they must have had. The lab was built in the early 1960s, remember?
Right, not just a couple of tables in a basement.
No, this wasn't some hasty setup in a cellar. This required significant planning, sophisticated engineering. You'd need proper ventilation systems, robust power grids, waste disposal units, everything necessary to run a full-scale biological testing facility.
And all underground, beneath an active public building.
Precisely, and all of this had to be done without attracting attention. from the public using the library, from the librarians themselves, municipal workers doing maintenance, or, you know, the authorities who'd normally inspect public buildings.
How do they even manage that?
It speaks to an incredible level of secrecy, and maybe even some level of complicity, or at least willful ignorance, within parts of the local infrastructure that allowed this monumental task to actually proceed undetected.
The audacity is just, it's chilling, really. They were essentially building this whole parallel subterranean world.
A secret world dedicated to forbidden knowledge.
Right beneath the feet of residents who were just, you know, checking out books. Maybe queuing for a local history talk or something. Completely unsuspecting.
And once that physical infrastructure was secretly in place, probably by the early 60s.
Then the real work began.
Then the testing phase kicked off pretty quickly, moving into the mid-1960s. And we need to identify the person really driving this, the individual who signed off, the entity responsible for both the intellectual vision and the criminal enterprise behind it.
The records point to one name, primarily.
Joseph M. Warren. He's identified as the lead scientist.
Okay, Joseph M. Warren. The visionary, perhaps. But the records are clear. He wasn't working alone, right? This wasn't a solo act.
No, definitely not. The sources explicitly confirm the existence of a research team, a group of people collectively running these highly illegal experiments.
So it was more like a structured, organized operation, like a criminal enterprise almost, but dedicated to radical biology.
That's a good way to put it. And that distinction is actually pretty crucial, I think.
How so?
Well, it means it wasn't just one individual making impulsive, maybe mad scientist type choices. It was a group consciously deciding to operate outside all the established ethical norms, all the regulatory guardrails that existed at the time.
Which suggests maybe they had support or funding.
It could suggest institutional support, maybe dark money funding, something that shielded them from the kind of scrutiny that research like this would normally attract, especially back then.
Right. And what exactly were they shielding? What was the big secret they were risking everything for? It brings us to the actual objective, the formula itself.
Yeah, and this is where it gets almost comically misaligned with the enormous risk they were taking.
Because the formula wasn't initially designed for, like, human enhancement or military applications.
No, not according to the records we have. Initially, its stated purpose was strictly to extend the lives of people's pets.
Just pets, like cats and dogs.
Cats, dogs, maybe hamsters, who knows. Domestic animals, but the goal itself was pretty extreme, mind you.
Step extreme.
This wasn't about just adding a few healthy months onto a pet's life. The formula, if consumed daily by the animal, was intended, supposedly, to almost double its natural lifespan.
Double. Wow. Good.
Think about the market for something like that, even back then. The grief people feel when they lose a pet is, well, it's powerful.
Immense, yeah.
So a promise like doubling the life of a beloved companion animal.
Yeah.
That could generate astronomical wealth, prestige.
Okay, so maybe it was about the money or the fame.
Mm-hmm.
That emotional driver, fueled by potential profit, maybe that's what made them willing to just disregard all the rules.
That's likely a huge part of it. The intersection of that potential profit and perhaps a certain kind of scientific hubris.
Yeah, I was going to say, I have to push back a little on just the financial driver. I mean, sure, the market potential was probably massive. But the sheer dedication required for this kind of radical biological alteration, especially for what seems like a non-essential function, relatively speaking, it suggests a really deep-seated scientific arrogance too, doesn't it?
I think so. Like, they believed they could, so they should, regardless of the rules.
And they seem to be prioritizing, what, the emotional desires of maybe wealthy pet owners over basic biological safety. Ecological stability, even.
That seems to be the case. And analyzing that ethical and regulatory failure is really central here. You have this team willing to conduct animal testing completely outside all legal frameworks. No government approval, no standard safety trials we'd expect today.
And nothing.
Nothing. All driven by this relentless pursuit of extreme biological longevity for domestic animals. You know, doubling a pet's lifespan, that requires massive transformative changes, probably at the cellular level, maybe even genomic.
Which they clearly hadn't mastered safely.
Not even close. And the sources are absolutely unequivocal on this point. The experiments, the formula testing, the lab construction itself, everything was explicitly categorized as highly illegal and not approved by the government.
So they knew. They knew the boundaries. And they intentionally set up their whole operation to exist entirely outside of them.
Precisely. They were performing fundamental science, potentially altering life itself in a way that was considered criminally dangerous by the state. They just chose to ignore it.
You have to place this in the context of the time, too, the mid-1960s.
Right. It was an era of intense scientific optimism, sometimes bordering on reckless. We were, you know, racing to the moon, unraveling the secrets of DNA.
There was this prevailing feeling, wasn't there, that technology and biology could solve pretty much any problem, even big ones like death or aging.
Exactly. But Warren's team, they broke a really fundamental boundary here. They weren't trying to cure cancer or end world hunger. They risked the stability of the local environment, the safety of the town.
For what? For the sake of an extreme novelty. A long-lived hamster, maybe.
That disconnection is key. The triviality of the stated goal compared to the catastrophic methods, uncontrolled biological mutation, that really defines this first act for me.
They weren't aiming for some grand humanitarian achievement. They were trying to mitigate pet owner grief through incredibly dangerous transformative science.
And that fundamental misalignment, that gap between their ambition and any sense of ethical gravity, that's what ultimately set the stage for the disaster to come.
Okay, so Act Two. We've got the illegal lab humming away beneath the library. Oh. We've got Warren and his team, the ambitious life extension formula for pets.
And the total disregard for legality or safety.
Right. Now we get into the phase where the science itself starts to go, well, violently and cognitively off the rails.
Yeah, this is where it gets really disturbing. And the sources make it very clear that turtles were not the first animals they tried this on.
So they'd experimented on others before.
Oh, yes. The records indicate pretty extensive preliminary failures. Before they even got to the turtle phase, it seems every initial experiment failed on other animals.
Like the pets it was intended for. Mm-hmm. Dogs, cats.
Presumably. Dogs, cats, maybe rodents are mentioned too. The documents suggest the formula was either just outright lethal or completely ineffective when used on mammalian subjects.
Hmm. Which must have made them pretty desperate.
Exactly. This points to a kind of desperate escalation by the team. They were likely increasing dosages, maybe fundamentally tweaking the formula in ways they didn't fully understand, just cycling through different test subjects with dangerous speed.
And desperation, as you said, leads to unexpected places. So then came the turning point, mm-hmm. shift to reptiles.
Mm-hmm. Turtles specifically. And when the formula was tested on a turtle, the initial assessment was, well, shockingly positive. The records say it seemed to work.
Seemed to work? What does work even mean in this context? The turtle just didn't die immediately.
We can only deduce, really. Working likely meant the turtle not only survived this radical treatment, but started exhibiting maybe accelerated biological resilience, or perhaps observable signs of rapid stable growth. Something that signaled to them that the longevity mechanism, whatever it was actually active in this species.
Okay, so the turtle is thriving, physically.
Physically, yes. And this is that classic, almost terrifying moment you see in stories about forbidden science, isn't it? The one subject that unexpectedly responds.
Yeah, the breakthrough moment that turns out to be something else entirely.
Precisely. Because that initial positive physical result, maybe longevity, maybe resilience, it was very quickly overshadowed by something far more alarming.
Which was?
A profound neurological and behavioral transformation. This starts showing up in the mid-1960s timeline entries, and this is where the simple concept of, you know, biological life extension just gives way to genuine uncontrolled mutation.
So the turtle started acting differently.
Differently is putting it mildly. The records state they began to act strange, almost human.
Almost human. Okay. That's a huge leap.
It is. This is the moment the formula stopped being just a longevity solution and clearly became this powerful agent of cognitive, maybe even evolutionary acceleration.
So it wasn't just making them live longer. It was making them smarter, mm-hmm. more aware.
It seems so. The test subject ceased being just a physically resilient pet stand-in and became, well, a creature exhibiting alarming, completely unpredicted intelligence.
We need to get specific here. What were the documented behavioral changes? What did acting human actually look like in a turtle?
Okay, the details are chilling. Firstly, the records mention they moved differently.
Moved differently. How? Faster.
The implication is more than just faster. It suggests a significant physical mutation was occurring, not just being slightly larger, but a fundamental shift in their gait, their posture, maybe their speed, something far beyond the slow, deliberate movement you expect from a typical turtle.
Could it imply upright movement? even then?
It strongly suggests structural changes, maybe to the spine or limbs, something that could potentially support more upright or bipedal movement. That's certainly how it was interpreted later.
Okay, that's disturbing enough, but you said neurological changes too.
Yes, and this is perhaps even more terrifying. It relates to their apparent observation skills and mimicry. They seemed sentient enough to engage in, well, deep learning.
Learning? How?
The sources specifically note they watched the scientists. Think about that. They weren't just passively sitting in their tanks waiting for the next feeding or dose.
They were observing.
Studying.
Exactly. Observing the lab's operational routines, learning the layout of their environment, assessing the patterns of their human captors.
Okay, that's creepy.
It gets creepier. This leads to the most critical and, frankly, horrifying leap documented. They started copying their gestures.
Copying gestures. Like waving. Or a bit.
The records aren't that specific on the exact gestures, but the implication is clear. That level of sophisticated mimicry, the ability to see an action performed by a different species, process that visual input, and then translate it into a novel physical response completely outside their own species' normal repertoire.
That implies a massive cognitive jump.
A huge cognitive leap, far, far beyond what you'd expect from a simple life extension formula. They weren't just living longer. They were, in effect, evolving right there in the lab into something approximating a sentient, intelligent being. And they were absorbing the culture of the lab.
Yeah. Recognizing cues, maybe understanding purpose from the humans controlling them is incredibly unnerving.
So this raises a really important question, doesn't it? Did the formula just, like, stabilize their cells somehow to make them live longer? Or did it actually unlock something else? Dormant genes. Latent potential.
Did it accelerate their evolutionary timeline? Maybe by millions of years, compressed into just months or weeks?
The mimicry suggests more than just longevity. It's not just a physical change. It sounds like proof the formula created an entirely new form of being, capable of advanced learning, integration.
It's like they were absorbing the knowledge from the library above them, but not by reading the books.
No, by observing the operators working beneath it. Chilling.
You have to imagine the tension in that lab for Joseph Warren and his team. It must have been unbearable.
On one hand, they'd achieved a form of biological stability, maybe even the longevity they wanted.
But only by simultaneously creating something intelligent, observant, and potentially extremely volatile. They had completely inadvertently created these sentient prisoners who were just watching and learning and biding their time.
And that volatility, well, it inevitably proved inescapable, didn't it?
It did. The sources establish a very specific, horrifying sequence of events that led directly to the public disaster.
The escape.
The escape. One specific night, after the lab had apparently closed down, the researchers presumably gone home for the evening.
Leaving the library dark and quiet above.
Exactly. The turtles successfully executed what seems like a coordinated breach. They broke free from their containment within the lab.
Coordinated? You mean it wasn't just like one found a loose grate?
The precision implied in the report suggests a non-random, probably intelligent event. Maybe they'd observed the locking mechanisms. Maybe they worked together. The records don't detail how, just that they did.
And they didn't just stay in the lab.
No. They escaped the underground lab itself and immediately ventured out into the town.
Directly into Pleasant Park.
Yes. This wasn't a quiet flight into the nearby Vermont wilderness trying to disappear. This felt like a targeted, almost aggressive foray straight into the human community.
So the secret scientific experiment had now officially crossed the line. It became a catastrophic civic security crisis.
Yeah.
Overnight.
Instantly. And the attack timeline that follows is just shocking, especially for its destructive speed and concentration.
What happened when they got into the town?
The turtles started breaking into homes.
Breaking in, like forcing doors, windows.
The implication is purposeful, calculated action, smashing through barriers to get inside houses. Maybe it was retaliatory, fueled by their captivity, maybe just driven by a primal desire for resources or freedom. Or maybe something else entirely. But it was definitely directed against the structures of human society.
And it suggests coordination, too, doesn't it? Not just random panicked animals running wild.
It really does. It implies they were working together, perhaps, not just acting on primal instinct. And the human toll was immediate and, frankly, staggering for a small town like Pleasant Park.
How many people were hurt?
Over 25 people were injured in that single night.
25. By turtles.
By these mutated turtles. The victims were local residents, ordinary people, completely blindsided in their own homes by creatures that simply should not exist.
And the injuries. Were they serious?
The sources describe the attacks as involving people being bitten, scratched, and attacked. To injure 25 people in one night suggests these creatures must have had significant size, surprising speed, a high level of aggression, and again, probably coordination among the escapees.
Let's elaborate on that description if we can.
No.
Bitten, scratched, and attacked. When you're talking about potentially large bipedal creatures.
Right. While the sources don't give us graphic medical details, the description strongly implies serious injuries. Deep lacerations from claws or beaks, puncture wounds, probably defensive wounds sustained by the residents trying to fight back in sudden, violent, close quarters encounters.
In their own homes.
In their own homes. This wasn't just a minor skirmish or a few nipped fingers. This sounds like a series of brutal assaults. A rampage, really, on an unprecedented scale for a place like Pleasant Park.
And the witness testimony must have been terrifying.
It provided the undeniable, terrifying visual evidence of the mutation. Victims consistently described their assailants with one chilling detail. They were walking turtles.
Walking turtles.
Upright. Upright. Bipedal. That description underscores that the biological transformation Warren had triggered wasn't just internal. It had resulted in mobile, physically imposing creatures capable of breaking into homes and inflicting serious trauma.
So the scientific truth, the result of the experiment, was delivered literally via violence right into the bedrooms and living rooms of the townspeople.
Exactly. The moment 25 people were injured by upright mutated reptiles bursting into their homes, any hope Warren and his team had of containing the truth, of keeping their secret, it was instantly annihilated.
The sheer violence of the rampage was the exposure mechanism. It blew the lid off the secret lab beneath the library.
Completely. And it forces us, looking back, to fully confront the ethical collapse that happened there. Their desire, their initial goal, was just to keep domestic pets alive longer.
Yeah, seems almost harmless on the surface.
But it led them down this path that directly resulted in mass civilian injury. The team saw the behavioral changes happening, the mimicry, the observation, the growing intelligence.
They must have seen it.
They must have. And yet, they failed to stop the process. They didn't destroy the subjects or shut down the experiment before it reached this point. It culminated in this single terrible night of violence.
They prioritized keeping their secret experiment going over the safety, the very lives of their neighbors living just upstairs, essentially.
It seems that way. The ultimate betrayal, maybe, was that the town's symbol of trusted knowledge, the library, was secretly hosting the creation of a threat that literally learned how to break down doors and attack them.
Okay, Act 3, the aftermath. That night of the attack, the rampage through Pleasant Park, that was the defining moment. It was like an explosion that just obliterated the cover story.
Absolutely. The scale of the violence, 25 victims reporting attacks by these bizarre creatures, meant there's no hiding it anymore.
So when emergency services responded, local police started investigating, maybe even state or federal authorities got involved eventually.
Mm-hmm.
They start asking why. Why was this quiet Vermont community suddenly attacked by things people are describing as, well, upright, aggressive, mutated reptiles?
The questions would lead inevitably downwards. The hidden lab's existence right there beneath the library, it must have been exposed almost immediately in the investigation that followed.
The secret was out, and the consequences for Warren and his research team.
They were swift, and according to the records, devastating, and legally very complex. Every scientist involved, including the leader, Joseph M. Warren, was charged.
Charged with what, exactly?
Multiple crimes. And this is important. It wasn't just a case of, say, violating research protocols or conducting unapproved tests. This was criminal negligence that directly resulted in mass assault.
Right. So we need to unpack that legal situation a bit, because it sounds pretty unprecedented. What does multiple crimes even mean when the things actually doing the attacking are these biologically altered animals you created?
It's a fascinating legal question. They weren't just charged with, you know, unauthorized animal testing, which they clearly did. They were almost certainly facing criminal charges related to severe public endangerment.
Okay.
Potentially reckless scientific misconduct resulting in grievous bodily injury. Maybe even charges related to the unauthorized creation and deployment, essentially, of hazardous or biologically altered agents into the public sphere.
So the legal system had to connect the dots, draw a direct, unambiguous line from Warren's illegal operation, his formula,
to the injuries sustained by those 25 people.
Yes.
The charges had to acknowledge that the scientist, by creating these things and then failing to contain them, maybe even by continuing the reckless experimentation after realizing the danger, they were directly responsible for the violent actions of the creatures they'd made.
So it wasn't just punishment for the research itself. It was for the creation and, effectively, the release of a dangerous new biological entity.
Exactly. It was the law having to adapt almost in real time to this bizarre, horrifying, almost cinematic reality that unfolded in Pleasant Park.
And the physical site, the lab itself.
Gone. In what must have been a highly symbolic gesture, the physical site of the crime, that hidden lab beneath the library, was permanently shut down.
You have to assume the cleanup operation there was intense.
Oh, absolutely. Securing that location, potentially decontaminating it, given the nature of the biological agents they were using and the, well, the creatures that had been engineered and escaped from there. That would have been a massive, highly sensitive operation, probably shrouded in secrecy itself.
So the immediate aftermath involved exposure, legal action, the shutting down of the lab. That provided a kind of closure for the authorities, maybe for the legal system.
Right. Case closed, in a way.
But crucially, the story didn't end there for the people living in Pleasant Park, did it?
Not even close. The incident transitioned almost instantly from being just a documented criminal case into something else entirely. Potent local folklore. An enduring, terrifying legend.
Because the lab was gone, the scientists were facing justice.
But the consequences. The actual creatures, or maybe creature that escaped, they were still believed to be out there. In the woods, in the shadows, part of the local ecosystem now.
And this belief, this folklore, it was fueled by actual sightings.
Apparently so. It was fueled by persistent, recurring sightings reported in the years following the incident and the lab closure.
For years afterward.
For years. And these reports, whether collected through local police logs, anecdotes, resident testimonies passed down, they seem to focus primarily on one particularly large creature.
One survivor.
It seems that way. Locals often claim they continued to see him. They use that singular, almost personalized pronoun him, implying a single terrifying survivor. Maybe the alpha of the group, the most successful mutation, or perhaps just the most intelligent or elusive escapee.
And the descriptions. Did they match the creatures from the attack night?
They were consistent, and they are the absolute core of this terrifying legend. This creature was universally described as being a massive turtle.
How massive?
Estimated to be over 7 feet tall.
7 feet.
7 feet tall. Just pause and picture that for a second. That's substantially taller than the average adult man. An enormous, incredibly intimidating silhouette to encounter.
Especially if it's, you know, a turtle.
Exactly. And critically, cementing its status as this intelligence-accelerated entity, this unnatural being, it was consistently described as walking upright like man.
Bipedal. Still walking upright.
Still walking upright. That bipedal movement, combined with its massive size, that's the tangible, horrific biological legacy of Joseph Warren's illegal formula. It wasn't just a story. It was, according to these accounts, a functioning, permanent mutation walking the earth around Pleasant Park.
The psychological impact of knowing, or even just believing, that a 7-foot bipedal reptile might be roaming the Vermont countryside around your town, yeah. It's immense.
It would change the character of the place forever. Furthermore, the sources often narrow down the timing of these legendary sightings.
When were they typically seen?
They consistently occurred after midnight, late at night, in the deep darkness.
Which suggests?
Well, it suggests the creature was highly intelligent, behaviorally complex enough to be strictly nocturnal, actively avoiding daytime human contact.
Learning to survive by staying hidden.
Exactly. It further confirms its advanced cognitive and behavioral skills. It hadn't just survived, it had adapted. It had learned the routines and schedules of its new environment, the human world it now inhabited on the fringes.
So let's just synthesize this for a moment. What does this all mean? Start with the pursuit of a longer life for a pet, a relatively small, maybe even understandable emotional goal.
Mm-hmm.
And the end result is a 7-foot tall, bipedal, intelligent, nocturnal creature haunting the streets and woods of a quiet Vermont town.
That really is the ultimate aha moment, isn't it? Or maybe the ultimate oh no moment.
It's the definition of a scientific endeavor going catastrophically wrong, creating this permanent, horrific cultural footnote, a local monster legend that you can't just rationalize away with police reports or court documents because people kept seeing it.
And the fact these sightings reportedly continued for years after the lab was shut down That's evidence in itself, isn't it? It suggests the biological alterations triggered by Warren's formula were stable. They were long-lasting.
So, in a twisted way, the formula did achieve its longevity goal.
It seems it did, but only in a form that was irreversibly mutated and apparently inherently hostile, or at least dangerous, to human life. The creature, him, was the living proof that the experiment worked.
Even as it embodied the catastrophic failure of ethics, oversight, and basic public safety.
It essentially turned Pleasant Park from an idyllic town into the real-life setting for a creature feature, a perpetual cautionary tale whispered after dark.
The lab beneath the library might be sealed off. The scientists might have served their time or disappeared.
But the physical manifestation of their unchecked ambition, the formula's terrible success, lived on. In the shadows, after midnight, maintaining its own survival schedule, the mutation was permanent, and the consequences of that secret experiment became permanently localized history.
So we've traced this incredibly bizarre journey, haven't we, from the quaint, unsuspecting exterior of Pleasant Park, Vermont.
Right down into the hidden depths. The highly illegal laboratory operating secretly beneath the public library.
We analyzed that initial scientific ambition, kind of audacious but maybe understandable, trying to double the lifespan of pets.
And then the catastrophic pivot, the shift from simple longevity to radical mutation. Remember those key phrases? The turtles acting human?
Yeah, observing the scientists, copying their gestures, and eventually somehow moving differently, achieving that calculated bipedal speed.
And then we witnessed the violent climax, that single brutal night that blew the secret wide open.
25 people injured, attacked in their homes, leading to the exposure, the legal fallout.
Charging the scientists effectively with creating the very monsters that caused the violence.
And finally, landing on that terrifying, enduring legend, the physical manifestation of all that hubris and failure.
Embodied in that persistent description from the later sightings, the 7-foot walking turtle sighting. That became the permanent marker, didn't it? Scientific ambition completely unchecked by ethics or foresight.
It feels like the ultimate lesson here maybe connects that specific incident in the 1960s to today's scientific landscape, too.
How so?
Well, when scientists attempt to radically alter the most fundamental biological laws, whether it's aging, like in this case, or species identity, or, you know, messing with genetic codes like we can now, is a violent, unforeseen side effect almost.
Yeah.
Inevitable sometimes.
It's a sobering thought. The researchers in Pleasant Park, they were essentially playing God, maybe, but with the simplest of creatures, turtles. And the result was just catastrophic.
So it raises an important question, I think, for you, the listener.
Yeah.
Especially when you think about modern biology, things like CRISPR gene editing, synthetic life being created.
Mm-hmm.
What lessons does Pleasant Park offer us today about managing that ethical boundary between, say, an emotional desire for biological modification, even if it's just for pets, and the immense, maybe unpredictable dangers of uncontrolled genomic restructuring?
That's a crucial point, because the creatures Warren's team created, they weren't pets anymore by the end. They were something else entirely, a dangerous new biological entity that proved its own viability through violence and successful escape.
It's a powerful, really unsettling reminder, isn't it, that sometimes the forbidden knowledge you chase down, it can create intelligent monsters that eventually return to the surface.
And demand a permanent toll from the society that, perhaps unwittingly, allowed them to be born in the first place.
Think about that profound consequence, and maybe that lingering shadow in the woods around Pleasant Park the next time you visit your own local library.
Makes you wonder what could be underneath, doesn't it?
Full timeline plus receipts available now. You can find all the documents and accompanying sources we based this deep dive on. Full timeline plus receipts at Inspector Story.